When supporting a loved one with feeding differences, it's easy to feel like you are alone. At Feeding Matters, our hope is for you to find the community, resources, and support that you need. Through our Power of Two parent-to-parent mentoring program, parents in need of support are matched with one of our volunteer family coaches who have lived experience with their own child and can offer emotional support, resources, and guidance to lessen the isolation that families face with pediatric feeding disorder, or PFD, as well as avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, or ARFID. Families can request a one-time phone call or a three-month or six-month match by filling out the request form on our website. A family coach will make contact via email first, and then by phone or text message, typically within 2 to 3 days. For more information, please contact us at 623-242-5234, extension 306, or email at info@feedingmatters.org. You are not alone.
Presented by Feeding Matters, with host Jacqueline Peterson and Dr. Haley Estrom. Feeding Does Matter.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Feeding Does Matter. I'm Jacqueline Peterson, CEO of Feeding Matters.
Hi, and I'm Haley Estrom. I'm an associate professor at the School of Nursing at UNC Wilmington. How are you doing today, Jacqueline?
Haley, I am doing fairly well. It's Friday, which is lovely. So excited to go into the weekend and always excited to see you and talk to our lovely guests. How are you doing?
I'm excited to talk to these three people we have on with us today. I'll start with Dr. Chrissy Brackett. She's a speech-language pathologist at the UNC feeding team.
Yes. And then we've got Dr. Donna Scarborough, who is a professor in the speech-language pathology department at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And then we've also got Jess Owens, who is a GI pediatric nurse practitioner. Welcome, Jess, Chrissy, and Donna. So excited to have you with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yes. So would love to hear a little bit about your backgrounds. So and kind of how you found yourself in the role of research and speech in general or feeding or however you want to talk about it. Chrissy, maybe we'll start with you first.
Sure. I'm happy to start. So, and I really appreciate you having us on today. And I guess I'll start with how I got interested in gagging and gagging research. So I have been in the field a long time. I've been a practicing speech pathologist for over 30 years. And when I started in the field in the early 1990s, we were seeing a lot of gagging in our patients. And I think the mechanism for gagging has changed a little bit. But one of the main things we saw was that when children were being evaluated for a G-tube, they were automatically also assessed for a Nissen fund application. And so when it was recommended that children would have a G-tube placed, there was a feeling that this would increase reflux for the child. And so surgeons automatically considered doing a Nissen fund application, which is a surgery to tighten the lower esophageal sphincter. They take the top of the stomach and they wrap it around the LES. And it was done pretty routinely back in the 90s. They were together. And so when kids would recover from that surgery, we saw so much gagging. I mean, because children needed to vomit or they still were refluxing. And so we saw a lot of gagging, and it was a major barrier to helping children get back to oral eating. And so that really sparked my interest in gagging right from the beginning. And I'll just say that a little bit about my background. I really had a lot of very strong medical mentorship right from the beginning. My original training was with Dr. Peggy Eicher on the CHOP feeding team, and she's a developmental pediatrician who was really looking at feeding from the lens of the medical domain. She was a very, very early influence for me. And then also early on, when I was trying to figure out how to help these kids with gagging, I met Paul Hyman. Paul Hyman came to UNC to give a grand rounds, and he was talking about fecal retention, which I had never heard about. I was a very young therapist, but I had read his article called Why Baby Won't Eat. And I was really fascinated because it just made so much sense to me. So when he came to UNC, we set up a meeting and we sat and talked about why kids won't eat, what are the barriers, how can we help kids with hypersensitivity? And for those of you that don't know Paul Hyman, he was a gastromotility specialist that passed away during COVID. Do you want to add something, Haley?
I wanted to ask when he came to UNC and you were able to talk about that.
It was after that Why Baby Won't Eat was published in 1993. So I think I met him in probably 1995. I met him very, very early on. And it actually started like a mentorship relationship that we had until he died. Like we would routinely email each other back and forth. But what stuck with me was he said to me early on, he said, there's one reason kids don't eat, and that's because it hurts. And so I have always taken a medical lens to looking at feeding. And even as a speech pathologist, I think I've spent like most of my career trying to interpret medical information for SLPs and to educate SLPs on looking at the medical barriers to feeding. So I'm being a little long-winded, but that leads me to Donna, who is the only researcher who has done any research in gagging and feeding. And I found Donna early on because of the research she had done. So we connected, I think, Donna, back in like 2010, and just also have had a long, long professional relationship and friendship. And then Donna was kind enough to be on my dissertation, my mentorship through my PhD program, so that I could then do my own study on gagging with Donna's mentorship. And Jess is one of our fabulous NPs on our feeding team. And the reason our feeding team is so busy and successful is because we do a lot of medical management with our kids. And we are one of the few teams that actually can look at the medical side of feeding and really, really treat it and really know we've really honed that over the years. So sorry, that was long-winded. But
I don't think it was. No, it was really interesting. And I think the way that everybody finds each other in the feeding world is also very interesting. Maybe, Donna, share a little bit about your background and then kind of how you got into this work and then and working with Chrissy a little bit further.
Sure. I've also been a practicing clinician for over 30 years as well. And my first 2 years, I was primarily an adult clinician, and I was working out in a major medical center out in Las Vegas. And so from there, I, you know, gained all this expertise in trach and vent and swallowing. And then they opened up a pediatric trauma center when I was there. And the peds clinicians were like, hey, do you like kids? I'm like, yeah, I love kids. And so they cross-trained me then with my knowledge. They needed someone that had the knowledge of the trach and vent side of things, the medical side of things. And then they trained me in all the developmental components of it. So I was out there for a couple of years. And while I was there, I was one of those people, clinicians, that I asked thousands of questions. I'm like, why this? Why this? Why this? Why that? And yeah. I go to the literature and there'd be nothing there. So truthfully, I decided at that point that I was going to go back and get my PhD. So I went to the University of Cincinnati at that point. And I started my program there. It was in the mid 1990s. And as a side hustle, in order to make money to eat while I was there, I took a position in a birth to three. It was in home health. And I was actually, because of my expertise, I saw all the medically fragile infants and toddlers who were discharged home. So I actually come from a home health background from that perspective. So I've gone from the hospital to home health while I was getting my PhD. And I ended up working for that company for over 9 years. And it was there that, again, like Chrissy said, we had so many kids who had, we called, there was the term gagging retching syndrome related to the fundoplications, but I was also noticing it in a broad group of infants and toddlers. There'd be a kid, I touch his legs and I'm like, oh, why are you gagging if you're touching the legs, or you touch the shoulders and they gag? And I'm like, what is going on here? And so while I was in school simultaneously, I was studying neuroscience and cognitive neuropsychology. I took every neuro class offered at both campuses at the University of Cincinnati, and I started thinking about it from a kind of a neurologic perspective. Sure. And my whole dissertation is actually on studying kids and developing a protocol of how to assess kids who might be hyper gaggers, even defining what gagging is. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I've been trying to figure out how to remediate it. And we'll get into that in a little bit.
Yeah, as we get further into the project. Thank you, Donna. Jess, how about you? How did you find yourself to this work?
Yeah, so being a nurse practitioner in grad school, there is this huge expectation to do research and to expand the field. Evidence-based care is such a huge component of that. And when you get out into the world of working as a nurse practitioner, you find many jobs don't support that. I worked my first 2 years in primary care, and it's, you know, it's a lot of sledging through. And I happened to come across an opening on the UNC feeding team, and it piqued my interest, and I applied and happened to know some people who also had connections on the team, and they told me that I would be just a great fit for the team. And when I was interviewing, they were going over the research, and not only, and they said it's an expectation of the job. And I thought that was so exciting, because of course it was something that I had never done before, and they would support me with it. And so that was just an exciting piece of the job. And little did I know I would completely fall in love with feeding. It's truly become a true passion. And Chrissy's point, you know, I had written some notes, to kind of make sure I made a comment on, but Chrissy already nailed it. You know, when the gut is not happy, the child won't eat. And that's what I wrote.
Yeah.
It seems very straightforward, and it's been an exciting 5 years that I've been working on the feeding team. And I've learned a lot from Chrissy.
Oh, wonderful, Jess. Thank you so much. And I do think it's unique for a team to be so upfront and supportive about research. And so that's something that I think is special about, because it's hard to do, and it's hard to make time for. And I know not everybody can, and that's okay too. It's just a really great effort that you all have, and that's exactly what we're talking about today: is some of your research and some of your work. And so we are going to talk about gagging, which is a topic that so many patients and families and caregivers and even clinicians want to understand more about. And as you all three referenced, there's still so much more to be known about it. Mm-hmm. So you've done a lot of work in this area, and we thought we would get into it. This podcast, as our listeners have heard us share many times, is about having the lived experience be part of research. And that means from the conception of what we need to start looking into to throughout the conceptualization and planning of it, and even the recruitment and research itself. And so part of that for us in this podcast is making that more accessible to everybody and kind of breaking down the paywall that research is often behind. And so would love, maybe Chrissy, you start with kind of the project that you all want to talk about and the work that you all are doing and what it means now, and we'll get into what it means in the future too.
Well, I got my PhD in 2024, so I'm a new researcher. I would consider myself pretty new, but I did my dissertation on looking at hypersensitive gagging in this population of children with pediatric feeding disorder. When I was in doctoral school, we did do a, what was it called, Donna, that we did that didn't get published yet? The review. We did a, I'm trying to think.
A scoping review.
A scoping review looking at gagging. We really wanted to get a sense of what was in the literature.
Like what's out there.
And I think we found like hundreds of articles that mention gagging. Very few actually looked at gagging as the primary problem. Gagging is almost always referred to as like a secondary issue of something else, or like it's kind of brushed over, but it's mentioned across pediatric literature. And that's what we found. I mean, the most research is probably in the world of dentistry, but we found medical articles. We found, you know, Donna has some feeding related articles. We found articles looking GI related, dentistry related. And but there just wasn't a lot kind of looking at one. We found that there was not a good definition, first of all. I will say there is not a uniform definition, and there isn't a standard way of assessing gagging and measuring gagging. So right away, we knew there was a lack of literature. Donna helped me design my study along with my other advisors. And what we did was we took children that were coming into the feeding team. We looked at new patients over a 3-month period, and we developed a gagging tracking tool is what we did. And we embedded it in the SLP note. So every time a child came in, we asked 4 questions. We said, does your child have any gagging response or behavior? Sometimes we had to explain what that means, because gagging is sometimes looked at as choking. So we had to explain. And if the parent said yes, then we wanted to know what the triggers were, what the response was. You know, so what is causing it for your child? Is it food? Is it sight? Is it touch? Is it smell? What happens when your child gags? Some kids recover very quickly. Other kids will vomit. Other kids fall apart and they can't eat. They can't be around the trigger. And then we wanted to know what the frequency was. How often was it happening? We actually dropped that one out because we quickly realized if gagging is severe, you avoid the triggers pretty early on. So we couldn't measure frequency. And then we took that information and divided the kids, the new patients, into 2 groups, gaggers and non-gaggers. And because we didn't know what the prevalence was in this group of kids. And then we took our gagging group and dug further into the 4 domains of PFD. And it was just very interesting work. I mean, it really taught us that the majority of kids coming into a feeding clinic do have a gagging response. And then we learned some surprising things, like the gagging group was very young. I mean, it was statistically significant that these kids were largely under the age of 5, most of them under the age of 3, and a lot of them had related GI issues. They had reflux and emesis, and they had those histories. And so there was a correlation, we think, between this. We still have a lot of work to do. Do you want to add to this, Donna, because you've been in this with me for the last 5 years?
For a long time. It's good to know. It's truly been, we've read thousands of articles.
Yeah.
And even and come through, it's been fascinating the breadth of diagnoses that are associated with gagging. And part of what we are also trying to tease out is the difference between hypergagging and a normal gagging response, because gagging is
one of the questions.
Yeah, no, gagging is an expected normal response, not in everyone. And that's some of the work I've done prior to this study, was even looking at a healthy group of, this was adults because of the IRB situation, having to get through that. But I was able to determine basically a range of responses, both from a sensory end, so where people are gagging. So are they gagging in the front of their mouth versus norm, where you're expecting it in the back of the mouth? And then the strength of the motor response. So are they really not, they can feel it, but they're not responding, versus you barely touch them and they're, you know, and you get this huge response and it's more like a retch. And then there's some individuals that actually have an emesis. And so it's much more complicated, I think, than people think. I think that it is, there's not kind of like the using the term cerebral palsy to describe kids who might have some sort of brain damage for whatever reason. I think the gag is both a primary problem in some kids, but I also think it's a secondary problem in other kids. And I think trying to treat it the same way, we're doing a complete disservice to the kids that we're seeing, and that we also aren't ever trying to eliminate the gag. We're trying to normalize it. And I think that that's a key point for people to understand. There are also times in normal development, during transition, kids should be gagging if they're trying new textures. But what shouldn't happen is they shouldn't start avoiding. That gagging is part of the normal process. And so I think there's some key things that we need to be thinking about as clinicians, and even how we talk about it, I think is going to be really important.
Mm-hmm.
Donna, can you give an example of a secondary problem or a secondary gag?
So I would say a child who, like the primary problem might be an underlying GI issue.
Uh-huh.
That's the primary problem. And gagging is secondary to that primary problem. You fix that primary problem of uh-huh. having extreme reflux or uncontrolled reflux, I should say, and then the gagging behavior will go away.
Okay.
So I think that that's and I think we have a lot of kids that are in that category.
Uh-huh. It was actually one of the things that I like saw in your work the most, that it was, you know, like a major headline was that kind of like relationship between that medical domain and undiagnosed GI challenge and then how the gagging, you know, comes out of that. Chrissy, it sounded like you wanted to say something about that too.
Yeah, I agree with everything Donna's saying. And I think the issue is we think of it as a primary problem when it is the barrier to progression. So even though it is maybe related to a different medical issue that needs to right. be treated, it's what we see when we're trying to feed a patient or when we're trying to progress them. What we see is the gagging. Like that's what is in front of us. Like we try to give them something and we get this huge gag. And I'll just reiterate what Donna said about like all gagging is not the same. I mean, gagging is not the same. And we think of it on this continuum from a hyposensitive gag to a normal gag in the middle. And on the right, we have our hypersensitive kiddos. So there's a lot of variation between gagging. And like Donna said, sometimes it's very appropriate.
And you right. said there's like needs and definitions. And so when you talk about that continuum, is that something that was defined as you were doing your literature search? Or was it something that you kind of discovered that is needed more in the literature in mm-hmm. order to be able to talk about this issue? Because Haley and I talk a lot about how language matters so much. And if we have shared definitions about things, it allows us to talk across disciplines, talk with lived experience a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like the language piece was a huge barrier to really looking into this further.
Well, when we started that scoping review, we started with three terms. We used gagging, retching, and pharyngeal reflex just to see what we would get. And mm-hmm. then we redid it later and added sensory sensitivity and smell sensitivity and taste sensitivity. We realized like people were talking about gagging, but they were calling it all these different things.
Yeah.
So.
Like choking and stuff too, probably.
Choking. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So in the clinic study that you did,
mm-hmm.
Were you looking only at gagging in response to food in the mouth, or were mm-hmm. you also counting like the toothbrushing gagging and mm-hmm. touching food mm-hmm. gagging and
looking at food gagging, anything related yeah. to, yeah, anything.
And that any was gagging. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was the, I think, Chrissy, how long did it take us to come up with that like, the profile that we put in there, and we've tweaked it a little bit just because truly it was like a brainstorming session.
Mm-hmm. And there's other sensory gagging too, like
100%. Like, yeah, you can gag.
So it's food and mouth gagging, like other kinds of mouth sensory gagging. And then, mm-hmm. like, is it like walk on grass and gag?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Like, we found that the gagging triggers that occurred in 20% or more of our gagging group were oral intake of dry solid food, mixed mm-hmm. textured foods, textured puree, and exposure to non-preferred foods, like gagging because you don't want a food. And the non-food related triggers were things like coughing and tube feeding and having a bowel movement and moving, and toothbrushing was one of the more common non-food triggers. Mm-hmm. So we looked at all of those triggers. And then with the responses, we grouped those into six primary responses. So kids were either recovering very quickly. Some of the kids were retching. Some were retching and vomiting.
Yeah.
Some kids needed more than a minute to recover. And then some kids just stopped eating. Like they would just totally stop eating. And we actually looked at our gagging group and found combinations of things. So it's hard to study because you don't respond the same way every single time. But we found over 23 groupings of responses. Mm. So it's very complex. I mean, and what triggers it for somebody and how they respond.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, based on that, the implications are for the clinical setting?
That's a great question. Do you want to start that one, Donna? Or,
well, I think number one is thinking about, instead of thinking about it as a gag reflex or not a gag reflex, to understand there is a continuum, and to understand there are potentially multiple different types of triggers or even underlying conditions that can be contributing to it. Number two, I would say that if your treatment isn't working and you haven't had a medical workup, that is 1,000% the next step. And I'm not talking about waiting for 6-8 months. I'm talking after 6 to 8 weeks. If you are not starting to even see any progression, why aren't you getting a medical workup? Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that you have to necessarily stop what you're doing, but you're going to be gaining information that is critical, and it might completely redirect what you're doing, or you might be focusing on something else while meds kick in or whatever it might be. And I think that it's in our profession, we have to be really careful. Again, I did home health, so I was not in a hospital. I wasn't able to necessarily bounce ideas off of people. And I was having to seek out the connections. And I think that's so important to do that. And now when I see a kid who potentially, you know, if they haven't been worked up, they need to get worked up. That's part of what we do. It's a requirement for them to even see me in the clinic. And a GI is critical. They have to make sure that I'll be honest, this is anecdotal, but I will say that if you have a kid that is, their reflux is not under control, their gag reflex will persist. It doesn't matter what you do. And so I think it's so important that you make those connections with the community and don't expect them to come to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Chrissy.
Piggybacking off of that, like one of the things Donna and I talk a lot about is the need to be able to assess a gagging severity, like some type of severity scale, because there's so many different interventions for gagging. And I know we will get to the interventions, but some children, it's very appropriate to start them in a therapeutic environment with touch or, you know, exposure to texture or some type of deep pressure, or maybe even acupuncture, which Donna can talk a lot about. But some other kids, you don't want to go, like if you're gagging and vomiting, you need probably to go right to the medical piece to get that looked at because it's so severe. And we see so many kids that come into our feeding clinic that have really been trying a therapeutic intervention for a long time, where really the only thing that is going to normalize that gag is probably some medical management, at least a period of medical management. And I think we just need to understand that better. I mean, this is anecdotal. There isn't research on this, but we've been doing this. We've been managing gagging in our feeding team for, you know, I don't know, 15, 20 years. It's like we've been doing this for a long time. So,
Jeff, I see you nodding. Where would you start with medical management for a child who's having gagging?
Yeah, I think it's really important to first get a good history to understand what may be the source of the gagging. We know that gagging is a response to some level of discomfort. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of times that patients, when they come into us, they may have already thought that they were being managed well if a pediatrician had prescribed some level of some management, you know, a little bit of Pepcid, a little bit of Miralax, if they're a little constipated. And so, you know, sometimes those are a little bit of a barrier. So it's really important to get a really detailed history. And I prefer to kind of think about the bottom up. Sometimes even gagging's in here, but
especially as a GI.
So kind of thinking about what are they pooping and what do those look like? And you know, the consistency, and are they pooping too much or not enough? And first line often is nutrition. So if we're thinking that this patient's discomfort is being caused from a milk protein intolerance or allergy, sometimes a formula
can be a game changer for these patients, you know, or a diet elimination of some sort. You know, moving on from that, you know, and then again, a lot of times we think from that perspective first, especially if we're looking at constipation and reflux. And there's also the consideration of diagnostics. We could have a whole talk on that. But we are seeing, unfortunately, a huge influx of inflammatory GI conditions just across the board, but eosinophilic esophagitis, which obviously causes a lot of gagging. It's just expanding more and more. And so we're doing more EGDs than we were a year ago. For these kids. And we have a much lower threshold for doing diagnostics, I think, now than we were before. Usually we would do some medical management first or some trials. And I think we're kind of reversing that course. But yeah, we do a lot of medications too. You know, PPIs are often a big one to make sure we're managing reflux well. Prokinetics can be very helpful to keep our motility, keep everything moving along. Cyproheptadine, which is a medication that helps kind of keep the stomach nice and relaxed. It also helps with appetite stimulation, is a great medication sometimes for gagging. And then, you know, when we think about how our guts and our brains are connected, sensitivity component there, neuromodulators are often used for gagging. We will often, depending on the severity of the gagging, we know it's a spectrum, you know, a large spectrum, and we'll sometimes try to, again, go from a conservative approach and then kind of work our way up the ladder for treatment. But first, sometimes we'll start with a gabapentin as a starting line if the patient's really severe. And we see really, really positive outcomes from that. And of course, you know, when you talk to a parent about putting their young infant on gabapentin, their eyes get very big, and it's concerning. But the great thing that I love about what I get to do is we can treat this pain and discomfort, and these medications are usually temporary. So we're able to treat this discomfort, get these babies feeling better, and then we're able to get them off their medications. And there's, you know, as far as we know from the research so far, we don't see any long-term side effects from these medications that we use because of the length of time that we use them, which is great.
And how do you make that shared decision-making with the family as you're trying to do that medical management into interventions?
I really like to, again, kind of give them the more conservative approach first when talking about things. I often will tell parents, especially if I know that medical management is necessary. I actually got this tip from Chrissy one time that you know, like, we often will not see progression if we do not involve medications. You know, just based off of what we have seen and with other patients. But I want to let parents have autonomy in their decision making for their child. And so I like to give them the avenues, and I always say we have options A, B, C, D, and E. So if this avenue doesn't work, we're going to go down the other avenue. And I always give them that expectation that there's a lot of trial and error. And sometimes that's frustrating and overwhelming for parents, but then sometimes it's really reassuring that they know that. I always tell them, I was like, we're going to get to the finish line one way or the other. And that sometimes gives them some peace of mind.
Chrissy, it looked like you had a thought too.
Well, and we're in our feeding clinic, we're all in the room together. So GI is going in with speech and the dietitian as well. And so we're really looking at all of the domains. We have psychology too that we pull in, but we're able to look at all of these domains and all the different angles and really support parents to make decisions. A lot of what we do is trial and error. It is. I mean, and you do want to go easiest to hardest intervention for parents. We know that. But I will say a lot of kids that actually come to a medically based feeding team, have tried a lot of things before they get to us. Mm-hmm. They do. I mean, they have tried a lot of things. We're not a first stop for many kids, unless you're coming out of the hospital with medical complexity. And those kids do come to us. But honestly, most of the kids we see, it's a second opinion, sometimes even a third opinion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or higher level of care they've been referred to.
And it's very appropriate that children start with a community therapist. Mm-hmm. It is. I mean, we are there for the kids that are really stuck. And I would say one of the things that's been really interesting is that the biggest driver of referrals for us and out from the outside is therapists. They're working with kids and they're stuck. And they say, I can't get past this and you need to see a team. And so we hope that we support the local therapist. So
yeah, that community relationship is really important. Donna, you have a perspective based on your background and or just your thoughts.
Well, my thoughts too, it's interesting that Jess and Chrissy and I have our professional lives have been devoted to this. Mm-hmm. And we're still doing trial and error. So the researcher in me is trying to unravel that trial and error, truthfully.
Yes.
And it's really trying to determine if we can start getting at least some subpopulations where we don't have to do trial and error, that if we have A, B, and C, community-based therapists do this. If we have D, E, and F, go ahead and do, this way. That's how my brain works about all of this. And now, truthfully, I'll be honest with you. I've even done some animal work to map the underlying neurologic causes of the gag. I'm the only one in the world that has done that. They're published. It's out there. It's published. I never thought as a clinician I would be gagging rats, but I did. And so not my favorite. And that could be a whole different podcast. But I'm really trying to understand the underlying neurology. And it is so because now all the stuff with back in the 90s was the decade of the brain was kind of that's the time of proliferation of a lot of information about the brain. And now we're doing this gut brain access. And, I could make those connections early on. But the more we learn about that, the more we can maybe start teasing out what clinicians and families should be doing with regards to their patient or their loved one. And so I could not be moving forward had I not met Chrissy. Now that we are able to, there's with two of us thinking in a research minded, research way, it's been really good for us to really bat ideas off back and forth. And did you see this? Or did you see that? Or, oh my gosh, I don't see that. And why would that work? Why would that work? And I think that's been the fun part of us kind of really reconnecting during her dissertation.
Yeah. And I love that you're leading with curiosity and not anything predefined. And because I think that's what the role of research is we're just trying to let the questions and the whys lead us on. And so because you are leading this, and especially in the role of gagging and what we need to do to both assess and manage it, where do all three of you see the future of this going? Or where would you like to see your future work going? Would love to hear more about as this is all taught you, where do you see it heading next?
I'll start briefly. Okay. I know Chrissy and I both want to jump in together. I would say I'll start by just saying that I really think that creating the language, a like language across disciplines, not just in speech pathology, but across disciplines, is actually, and that we're starting at the foundation. We're starting at the very base, and that is the key. So everyone knows what we're talking about. That has to be the first thing. Chrissy, do you want to jump in there?
Yeah, no, I agree. I would just tag on to that, a way to uniformly assess gagging, so that we have a tool that actually helps us really look at severity and direct treatment. And then, of course, we need lots and lots of studies on different types of treatment. Who needs medical management? Who can start with a therapeutic strategy? And I have to throw in the SALT technique. Have you heard of this, Jacqueline?
I mean, only just because you presented it.
Yeah.
I would love for you to share with our audience.
Actually, this was one of the most fun parts of the research we did. So we read, when we were doing the scoping review, we read like every single paper that even mentioned the word gagging in a pediatric context. And I came across this old dental paper called the Friedman Salt Technique. I think it was, it's pretty old. I forget the year, but it's pretty old. And it talked about how salt can inhibit the gag. And so I was teaching and I asked, a grad student came up to me and she said, I can't take pills. And I said, well, I just read about this salt technique. Will you try it? And she went home and she salted her tongue before she took her pills. And she came back the next week and said, guess what? I can take my pills. And it's just kind of gone on from there. I mean, Rachel gave me permission to talk about her, Rachel Conrad.
Yeah,
she gave me permission to mention this. Like, so I'm so grateful to Feeding Matters for letting me present my research a couple years ago. And Rachel came up to me during the conference and said, hey, I have really severe gagging and I can't brush my teeth without gagging. And I said, will you try this for me? Will you try the salt technique? Yes. And she videotaped herself. And the next day she said, oh my gosh, I can brush my teeth. and I just connected with her to make sure it was okay that I mentioned her name. And I'm going to ask you to jump in here, Donna, because what she told me was she used salt for about 6 months. She said it got better, easier and easier and easier. And she doesn't need it anymore unless she's sick. And you've always told me, Donna, you have to get cognitive control over your gag. And do you want to jump in here with that?
Yes. And that's what kind of complicates things is that the gag reflex is all driven by voluntary muscles. And so it is something that some individuals can learn how to suppress. Remember, I lived in Vegas. There are sword swallowers. And you think, how do you suppress the gag? So people can learn how to suppress the gag. But I also think that I've been trying to figure out the underlying neurologic underpinnings of what salt related to what I know about the system of the gag at a complex level, like very detailed level of the neurology. And I've been reaching out to some other professionals around the country who have expertise in like salt neuroprocessing. And the only thing I will also say about these anecdotal things, there's other anecdotal things out there. Like I've done something, there's a pressure point on the palm of the hand that you can use that moves the gag reflex posteriorly. I've published on that. But I also need to caution people because with that, you can also reduce heart rate. So I'm hitting some autonomic nervous system response. It's called a parasympathetic response, which means I'm lowering heart rate. And there might be some individuals that would be dangerous for. So when we talk about throwing these ideas out, we love the ideas, but we also need to think about what populations might this not work
for. Who is it for?
And an adult, they can tell you things and make certain decisions. But in a child to try something, you need to be very careful because you also don't know behind the scenes, like in the body, all the different things that are going on. So I would say if you have ideas, you can send them to Christy and I, and we can kind of hash through things and just chew about, what are you trying and why is it really that works, you know? Because I've had lots of conversations about not just salt, but other things too that people have found that have been very helpful and that have worked. Just kind of a caution.
No, it's important to make sure that piece is there as well. As we kind of narrow in our time together, is there anything that we didn't ask that you wanted to make sure you shared with our population, whether that's healthcare professionals who may have a piqued interest in this or are working with children with gagging, or parents or caregivers or patients like Rachel themselves?
Jess, you want to start?
Yeah, I just forgot to mention when we were kind of going over some of the medical management of gagging. Sometimes when we go full circle, I would kind of start with a nutrition piece. Sometimes we go full circle and end with a nutrition piece. We talk about kind of food is medicine. And for some of our G-tube fed kids, putting real food in the gut, it's
a game changer for gagging. And there's a lot of commercial products that make real food blends that we use, and we can sometimes see some great benefit from that. So I just forgot to mention that. So
I'm so glad you said that, because I agree wholeheartedly. We see a lot of improvement with food-based formulas.
Yeah. And then parents even want to blend up their own dinners and do that. Sometimes that's a fun change for them as well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely collecting gagging stories and cases, and I have a whole file of kiddos that we've managed their gagging in different ways. So I think I would just like people to know there's a lot of hope and there's a lot of things we can do to help gagging. And on the flip side of it, for therapists, I think the PFD definition, that framework makes so much sense to assess feeding disorders, because we can't fix everything as therapists. But a lot of kids still come to therapists first. So we have to recognize these barriers and know when to pull in the rest of the team if you're not working on an interdisciplinary team. But there are things we can do to help these children, these infants and children, with their gagging and get them past it. You know, we wouldn't expect anybody to eat if you had that kind of gagging response. It's so unpleasant.
And very unpleasant, very miserable experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there's a lot of things we can do. And we couldn't do our jobs without people like Jess. We couldn't. I mean, I really think I just think you have to have those pieces to help kids get better.
Well, I think you've always been an excellent example of a collaborator, Chrissy.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, I would say that for this particular challenge, I would say collaboration, collaboration, collaboration. Mm-hmm. And make sure your toolbox is big and that it's not just one. Right. There's not just one thing in your toolbox or two things in your toolbox. Or you go to a conference and you're like, oh, I'm going to do this. Think about why you're doing it and who it makes sense for and how long are you going to try it for if you're not sure if it's going to work or not. Mm-hmm. And when do you pivot? So start kind of doing some, like as a clinician, really start thinking, not like mindlessly saying, oh, I'm going to follow this protocol. Well, if the protocol isn't working, it's okay to pivot, you know? And I think that I agree with Chrissy. I'm actually excited that I've been able to think about these questions in such a way, and hopefully we'll continue to drive forward and come up with some of the deeper answers that we're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree. I'm really excited for your future work in this. It's something that the field needs so much and so desperately. And also always love the idea of shared definitions across disciplines. It's something that we at Feeding Matters feel very passionate about too. So just all three of you, thank you for your work in clinic and thank you for your work in research as well and pursuing this as a field changing issue. Yeah, Chrissy, go ahead.
I'll just say that Donna and another one of our colleagues and I are presenting on gagging at the International Association of Pediatric Feeding and Swallowing Conference in September in Denver. And we're going to show cases and we're going to kind of take a deep dive into this topic. So if you're interested in hearing more, we're going to be together at that conference.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing. Yeah. Anything else that we missed?
I don't think so.
It's so great to see all of you and to meet you, Jess and Donna. And thank you so much for coming on and sharing this with our community. If you want to reach out to them, we'll have their information available. Thanks for joining us on Feeding Does Matter. See everyone next week.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.